Hey everyone, it's Quinn here at the top of the episode, and I just wanted to let everyone know a couple of things. First of all, I wanted to give a trigger warning for this episode. There is a brief discussion of Orientalism, homophobia, and I think that there's a mention of slavery as well. So I just wanted everyone to know about that up front. I also wanted to say that from here on out, you can expect the show to come out about every 2 weeks. So that should be every other Friday. And soon we're actually going to be recording a wrap-up episode on this entire book. So if anyone has any questions that they would like to ask us, you can send those to hubwordbound@gmail.com. All of the episodes are probably not going to be out before we get to that, so some of your questions may wind up being answered by the podcast. But if you have any questions for any time in the future as well, feel free to email us there, hubwordbound@gmail.com, and I hope that you enjoy the episode.
Welcome back to Color of Magic. We are doing the thing, and apparently the color of magic is money.
Yeah, I read the book and I decided that probably it was really hard to get past the first part of the book because I found myself neck deep in a big pile of gold coins and gems. And I've just been counting those mostly since I finished reading the book.
Yeah, and that's pretty dangerous because then you have those. And what you going to do with all that money? You have to spend it somewhere, right? Not going to hoard it like a dragon. That's for later parts.
No, that's the thing. It's about circulation is probably the number one thing. And I will say it's immediately caused some distress in my interpersonal relationships. My wife isn't talking to me. I'm sort of estranged from my cat because I'm thinking about the proper way to circulate this. I don't want to be careless. I don't want to, like, for example, engage in charity. I don't want to just like throw it out there for people who might need it. I really need to make sure that it's being productive and generative, I think, is the most important thing, right? Like whenever you have a big pile of money, wherever you put it, it needs to be generating more money. It needs to be creating feedback loops because that lets you know that you're a good and a valuable person.
I don't know what can create revenue, but have you considered getting into insurance?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that could be good. I also probably need to insure my large stack of gold coins in case anything happens to them.
Yeah, you don't want to get damaged because the cat got to the gold coins and now they are worthless.
Oh, yeah. No, that will depreciate the value pretty quickly. If a cat comes into contact with your money, it's pretty much over. I really should invest in a policy.
You know, you should lobby some legislative bodies.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe if you have a local oligarchy, maybe you should get some money in their hands.
Yeah, I know that there's at least like local business districts, you know, that are trying to promote tourism, people coming in to the area. They want to make sure that goods and services are exchanging. People are having like a good, memorable time. Okay.
I think that's it. Tourism.
Yeah.
I think you should get into the local area. You should check an impoverished minority, you know, something that is not on a high position. Empower them to do violence. And have them be a force gentrifying stuff around you so it becomes a nice place for tourism.
Okay, yeah, I think so. We pretty much solved that. Should get me back in the good graces of my wife and my cat. And I think that pretty quickly I'll find that I'm like a sort of exalted figure in the local community, because everybody loves feeding tourism and gentrification. So I'm pretty excited about that. I think that this book's got some pretty good ideas in it.
Yeah, I think this neoliberalism, there might be something up to this.
Oh, yeah. God bless Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. We couldn't do it without you. Shout outs to some real ones.
Yeah, I mean, there is no society, but we can at least always count on them. They are always there for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, like, speaking of which, we're here for the first part of Color of Magic.
Yeah, and it has converted us to the light of the free market. I'm abandoning anarchism forever. And, praise the state.
Mm-hmm.
And all the recruitment of our money to the private sector.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much. God. So there's a lot to talk about there, for sure. Like, genuinely.
Mm-hmm.
So how about we start with just like a quick summary of what actually happens in this part, which is interesting because it's kind of both a lot and not a lot. My version of the book, it's like 84 pages long.
Yeah, it caps at 76 on mine, but yeah. It's like half-ish of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's much more dense. Well, spoilers ahead, than I found the other parts. But if you go to what actually happened, it was not that much. Let me see if I can summarize this. So we read the first part of Color of Magic, which is also called Color of Magic. And it's roughly the first 75-80 pages of the book. And we are introduced to the Discworld. We see the Discworld, how it is in all its four elephants and turtle glory. We have a prologue, and then we start in medias res with the destruction of the city of Ankh-Morpork. And we see a frame that is a flash forward to the events that we're going to see through the first part, in which we meet or protagonists, such as they are, the failed wizard Rincewind and the disc's first tourist, Two Flowers. And they narrate two point of view characters, the events that transpired. And after this long, awkward shyness that the book seems to actually starting, then we actually see the narrative, which starts with the arrival to Ankh-Morpork, the Ur City, the platonic idea of city, the center of the disc. The first tourist arrives there, and we follow the first tourist as he stumbles doing bits and disrupting the local economy. We are introduced to Rincewind, which serves as the guide. Then we follow along as multiple incidents happen to these characters, which eventually learn to the introduction of very creative financial tools, such as insurance, and we discover that there is a power stronger than magic, which is economy. And we see the effects of this disruption that leads to the destruction of the city of Ankh-Morpork. And we end up meeting back to our so-called heroes as they resume their journey across the disc and away from the destruction that they caused. Am I forgetting anything?
Not anything that I don't think that we'll get into as we sort of like break down the specifics. Yeah, it's like you have a framing device, you have a series of goofs and gaffes, which then come to a head with the destruction of the city that had been signaled ahead of time. So I feel like, especially if we want to like start like walking through this, breaking it down, Terry Pratchett starts off with some choices in terms of humor.
Oh, actually, I want to do a bit of a celebratory parade myself. I don't know if your book version has it, but my edition has a foreword by Terry Pratchett.
Oh, interesting.
And considering the whole thesis of this show, I was chuckling in delight.
So mine has it, but I didn't read it.
Oh, you should. In fact, you should read it right now.
Okay. That's fascinating. Okay, I just read the introduction.
Yeah, I think The two last paragraphs are just...
The two last paragraphs are really interesting, whereas the actual introduction here of the foreword, like, the lead-up to those paragraphs, I feel some tension in those, in the way that he's, like, describing... So, to talk about what the foreword actually does, Pratchett is talking about where the idea for Discworld came from, and he articulates that the idea was lying around and didn't look as though it belonged to anyone. It's one of the great ancient myths. Found wherever men and turtles were gathered together, the four elephants were an Indo-European sophistication. The idea had been lying around in lumber rooms of legend for centuries. All I had to do was grab it and run away before the alarms went off. Which is fascinating in that he articulates that it belongs to no one at the same time that he is engaging in the theft of it.
Oh, he is British.
Right, yeah, that's sort of the thing, isn't it? You get this...
enclosure.
The duality of Pratchett shows up right here in this introduction, where he talks about like this Indo-European sophistication, articulating this as being a little bit quote-unquote exotic, and then him taking it into his own hands for the purposes of production of this novel. And then in the back half, it gets like really interesting and starts playing in that discursive space that we were talking about, where he says, quote, "The Discworld is not a coherent fantasy world. Its geography is fuzzy, its chronology unreliable. A small traveling circle of firelight in a chilly infinity has turned out to be the home of defiant jokes and last chances. There are no maps. You can't map a sense of humor." So that sort of gets into a lot of stuff in terms of the impulse toward lore. Yes, so the impulse toward lore, which for this project, Ludo made a purchase that I would love her to talk about because, oh my God.
Terry Pratchett and Stephen Briggs, the ultimate Discworld companion. All of Discworld included, divided in lore bits, and here to be produced. At any moment that Queen desires, we can open this cursed tome and see how nerds see Discworld.
What's so interesting here is he talks about this lack of coherent logic, this defiance to mapping, and yet in your hands you hold what is ostensibly a map.
Which again, it's back to the contradiction, because what is a map if not the enclosurement of the territory,
mm-hmm.
and codifying it on something that is glorified that then can be mapped to an imagined community. It's, at the same time, there is from the part of Terry Pratchett an acknowledgement that he's a vessel, that this world is something that already existed and was on the process of becoming, which is what we propose it to be accompanying through this project. But at the same part, he exists in the neoliberal age, which cannot allow something like that just be. And the way that this world becomes what it is this damn thing.
Right. So there's this impulse to, and again, it shows up in that framework. That, and obviously he's being sort of cheeky. He's making jokes. I don't want to say like, yeah, he literally went in and physically stole Discworld. Like, I know what jokes are. I know what's happening here. But it does sort of fall back to this impulse toward capturing something, right? To like, to capture it, to possess ownership of it. And then to use that ownership to produce something, quote unquote, of value, which I feel like that lore companion is like an extreme example of that, where it is sort of like a secondary capturing, right? Like the Discworld lore or like the Discworld books have been written. And so now you're taking this fantasy canon, this authorial canon, and you are recapturing it. You are articulating boundaries to it now to distill it down into a tome that you get that says like what the things are.
Yeah, and I think this is essential to the part of building a superstructure around these works. It's like you have the structure, the novels, the actual writings of Pratchett, but then the way that it actually fits, the way that they want to slot in over in certain slots, that requires a different superstructure. And creating something like these lore books is essential to this process. I think, yeah, it's the final step of capture. And if one wants to be more generous, you can say that the novels themselves, it's a process of stewardship. It's Terry Pratchett taking stewardship of these stories that and jokes that there have been variants across time and doing their contribution, ensuring that they are well taken care for and passing the torch. But this is poor ownership. It is the creation of an estate that takes these ideas and closures them and is ready to sell them for merchandise or just casual consumption.
And so that also puts us in conversation here with the context in which these things are being produced. These are being made under capitalism, under neoliberal capitalism specifically. This Color of Magic came out in 1983, right?
Just at its rise. Second term of Thatcher was that year.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see it on the text even.
It's really apparent in the text. And it's something interesting that I think Pratchett does here is... We talked about the works being sensitive to vibes, and the vibe of neoliberalism is captured and then intensified and articulated in this first section of the book in a really interesting way. So I think that that's really important to bear in mind is the combination of when was this produced, and then again, how does this continue to speak to the context that we find ourselves in now, which I find very, very interesting. I also want to say, in terms of the lore book, I'm realizing, I should have said this before, the way that this enclosure happens, right? The way that these definitions are sort of carved out and we abstract the territory to objectify it also involves closing a lot of the discursive doors that get opened. Things need answers. They're not allowed to be in conversation anymore. You need to terminate the conversation so that it can fit in particular confines.
And he says himself best, you cannot map a sense of humor. So you need to kill the sense of humor so that you can do that. And sense of humor is one of the most honest forms of discourse and conversation. So it is, on his own words, that you cannot map these things. So you have to kill them before you make them your trophies. And yeah, I think, again, it's a thing that is surprising is that their batch just has... He is very good with vibes, and he's very good at being aware of the positioning in which he exists at a given moment and the things around him. And the problem is, well, sometimes the vibes are rancid.
Yeah.
But he's there. He's seeing the vibes. He's not bullshitting you. He's not bullshitting himself, apparently.
Absolutely. I think that just creates an interesting... context in which we are experiencing this thing. We have this piece of sort of codification. And so I'm interested to see how that relates to sort of what we come into here. But let's get into the prologue. You ready for that?
Yeah. Sorry for interrupting you with this, but what were you saying about Terry Pratchett's humor on the prologue? And we immediately being hit with the prime example of it.
Yeah, so the prologue here articulates what the Discworld looks like. There's a great turtle, there's these elephants on it, and then there's the disc that spins atop it. And he talks about here two theories of creation, or like the state of the world beyond the Discworld, right? Like, what is Atween, the great turtle? What's the deal there? So the first one that's posited is that the turtle came from nowhere and would continue at a uniform crawl or a steady gait into nowhere for all time. Whereas the second one, which is framed as kind of a jab or like an acknowledgement of religion, which is that the turtle is going to a spawning ground or a mating ground for other turtles who are the stars in the sky, and they will briefly and passionately mate, and new turtles will be born from that. And this is all to say that he wanted to make a joke about the Big Bang hypothesis, because there's a lot of turtles and they're having sex, and they're big turtles.
The man had to do it.
Yeah, it's kind of a cringeworthy joke. It definitely, I sighed when I read it. But at the same time, there's this way that it's done that you can see the guy couldn't help himself. Like, he sort of had to do it, which I think softens the blow a little bit. Like, you can see the impulse there.
Yeah. The man is willing to do anything for the joke. He's willing to shoulder all the cringe. He's like the Atlas holding the firmament, and the firmament is cringe.
And like, that's it pretty much for me for prologue, because we don't have all that much in terms of like, yeah, okay, this is what the world is. And at this point, we just sort of have to be like, yeah, that is what the world is. That's what, okay, thank you for setting the stage. And then he makes a joke, and then they move on and start part one. I don't know if you had anything else to say, though.
I'm curious about, because you tend to think about these things more than I do, at least in this kind of scale, about the world building that is created this and this your first introduction. And personally, what I found curious that I did not remember is how much this part, what is not the jokes, is how the epistemology about living in this universe that is for elephants on top of a turtle came to the people of the disc. It is very focused on how they discovered that their world is like this and how they deal with the fact, which then is delivered in the form of a pinnacle of a dad joke. What are kind of the worries and anxieties that they have about the knowledge that they prioritize? And again, as someone that is a scientist, it's very fascinating that the actual content of the prologue, other than describing the world and making a joke, seems to be how knowledge about the world is created.
Yes, I definitely actually think that that's interesting and something to talk about, because you have this formulation of this world, and oftentimes when you get something like that, I do feel like it just sort of like stops there, where they go like, yeah, that's how it works. But here you have this articulation where people are engaged in like attempts at empirical observation. Like they are going to try to observe things, maybe measure them in some way. But when you have a defined edge of the world, he creates this interesting thing where people have like built a big like lift sort of thing where they can like drop an observer down from the edge of the world and like look around and see what's happening out there, which I think is an interesting way to engage it beyond this simple sort of matter of fact, well, that's the edge of the world. And so I do think it's interesting that this does get engaged, because it shows, I think, fundamentally that the people who live in this world are curious about it in a way that I think speaks to the way that people are curious in real life. But it also invites you into this combination space of a criticality of what you're being told, but also in some way suspending that or addressing the tension that can exist there by letting you know that the people in these spaces are also thinking about these things.
So, what do we have next?
The first 7 or 8 pages of this part, or like the first several pages of this part, are interesting because they didn't do a lot for me. They felt very rote, which is interesting. Like, I feel like I regard them better on the backside of having read what we read, because they do some framing and contextualization here. One thing that I do think is of note particularly is on page 7 in my version of the book, there's just this giant footnote about the cardinal directions of the disc and how people articulate directionality in this world, which again is interesting. It's also fascinating in that this does feel a little bit like the interjection of lore in a certain way. Like, okay, here's your little wiki article, which feels kind of weird. But things are configured by if they move from relative where you are toward the disc, or like toward the hub of the disc, or toward the rim of the disc, and then sort of like the east-west configuration, as I'm thinking of it at least, is if it's toward the, well, like along the spin of the disc, sort of a clockwise, or Wittershins, the counterclockwise, like against the spin of the disc. And because it literally impacts the formatting of the pages so much, it feels like it carries a tremendous sense of weight in the way that the reading is structured to me. It is intrusive. And I don't know if it's meant to be intrusive or informative or both, but it's also funny. I don't know. Like, at least for me, sometimes, depending on how I'm feeling about a text, I will be compelled to either really quickly glance over or skip entirely something like a footnote. Like, it depends on what's going on. And I read this completely, like, thoroughly, but I noticed a tension within myself there with those impulses, with how much page space this thing was taking up. And I don't know if this was the case in your copy, Ludo, but this takes half a page. It takes half a page, and then it bleeds over into maybe the bottom fifth or sixth of the next page.
I have to say, in my copy, it is at the end of the book that the footnote is, and it's much better read.
That would be way less intrusive, because again, it feels like I'm sort of being like plucked out of the context and given this like little wiki page, this entry in the encyclopedia, and then being like kicked back out in a way that it doesn't fit the flow of what's being presented. There's not a way to like, and obviously there's an acknowledgement of that because it's a footnote. There's not a breaking of the moment, because the authorial voice in this book isn't afraid to just talk about some bullshit, right? He'll stop and he'll just start telling you about something. I mean, that's what the preface was, or the that's what it was, right?
Prologue. You call it prologue.
That's what the prologue was. I completely forgot the word prologue there. I got so tossed about by this like reading experience. And so it's interesting that yours is formatted that way then.
Yeah, I think that's something that happened in later editions, because a thing that Pratchett is going to become famous for is his use of footnotes. And you probably notice already on this part, Pratchett writes the way that I think, which, I mean, if there is a random tangent that I remember, I'm going to interrupt whatever I'm talking about and do that. And he does that fully, straightforward, or sometimes he uses brackets. A thing that he starts doing later is using footnotes for that. So there will be these big, massive footnotes that are basically telling their own story. At this point, he's still playing very much with it. So this is why you see them the three ways. You see that one footnote, then you have he just starts talking about something else unrelated, and you have the brackets. He still experiment with those, and honestly, the footnote did not work to me on this one. So I'm curious to be if they will start working on some of the next book, because if this was the sole experiment, I would say go with the brackets. Because the brackets work much better in this book for me than the footnotes.
And it's interesting because there's an assumption that goes into the creation of a footnote, right? There's this sense that this is in some way important for understanding the context of what is being presented to you. And it's important enough that they need to make note of it within the text. There's an asterisk that says, hey, look at me. And then you have a footnote that follows that. And I don't think that this is even necessary, because it doesn't create a joke. There's not a joke that's being conveyed to me through this footnote. There's not a joke here. It's just showing you how a compass works. I mean, they talk about compasses later here, but they sort of talk about, you know, the cardinal directions. And if they had just started saying hub word or rim word or like Wittershins, that would have been fine. They're like, I don't think that would have been disruptive to the reading process.
Yeah, because in practical terms, it's basically he's introducing terminology and the glossary, which is very funny because for someone that jokes so much about fantasy, tropes and cliches, what is more cliche than the first 30 pages of a book being introducing you to weird capitalized terminology and what that means in that world? And it's funny that this footnote ends up doing the same effect and causing the same reaction from me.
Yes, exactly. My inclination is to talk about this in the context of it feels like this isn't a very confident move. It feels like it's not confident in a piece that is. Otherwise, this first portion of the book seems very confident in what it is. And I don't want to say that, or I don't want that to be understood as me saying, like, Terry Pratchett, the guy, is insecure. But again, we're talking about, like, the bounds of the text itself and the way that it's constructed. And it feels like there is a strange intrusion of a lack of trust in the reader to hang with things that feels in conflict or in tension with the way that almost everything else here is formulated.
Yeah, it's like, I remember commenting with you that the beginning seems... It seems like he really is not confident and how to start with these things. He seems very unsure and taking steps in and back, chuckling at dad jokes, then volunteering this bit of information, seeing as you react, then stepping back. It's very unsure. It's weird, considering how we know how this is going to end up. The first steps seem very unsure.
It's really not putting a strong foot forward, I will say that. And I think that it's remarkable in that sense, that that's what stands out to me most about this flash forward that starts the book, is the weird, intrusive nature of this footnote. The rest of it is pretty perfunctory. Aside from, I think, we do get the narration here about Ankh-Morpork being the Ur city, right?
Yeah, that's when I label this as when we meet our first character, because I think that Ankh-Morpork is not only introduced as the Ur city, he's introduced as a character probably with most in details than any other character so far.
Oh, certainly Bravd and the Weasel, these two sort of heroes, like capital H heroes that we meet at the start, they're not really characters. They're fixtures, really. They're not characters, where Ankh-Morpork is a character. And framing this as being the Ur city, the city from which epistemologically or metaphysically other cities sort of follow and take shape, and like it is quote unquote the template, starts to be interesting in that it starts asking or raising questions about the politics of the urban. In what ways is this thing constructed? And how are we to understand those as then reflecting out across what other cities look like? Because if I recall the way that it's phrased, it's not only that this thing is reflective of the way that all cities work on the disc world, but like, no, he's sort of saying like the cities that exist on Earth are reflections of Ankh-Morpork as well.
Yeah, that it's the ultimate city of adventure, the hub. And it seems like on this point, he's going into the touchstones of fantasy. I think there's a lot of Lakmar on this interpretation of Ankh-Morpork. And the interesting thing here is that the other characters that we have on the scene, basically Guts and Danny DeVito, they are this Grimauser. This is just, he's doing Grimauser. These are the same archetypes of the two guys, the big guy, the small guy, the sneaky one, the strong one. It's that thing. They are. So we have this platonic Ur city that every city is an echo of. And we have this, the most fantasy protagonists of every fantasy protagonist that there are. And they are basically just there to kind of recognize it, just as witnesses of Ankh-Morpork being Ankh-Morpork. Well, and its demise.
And they're also there to be witnesses to Ben Rincewind and Two Flower when they show up.
Which are not much of characters either when they show up.
No, they aren't. Which I think brings me to the other thing that's like deployed here, where you see them talk about the reflected sound as of underground spirits, which Rincewind talks about as being this powerful force, a kind of magic. It's very, very strong that we will come to learn is economics. And this starts something that we'll see throughout this portion of a combination of defamiliarizing the normal or like the contemporary. So, or modernity or what have you, however you want to articulate that. So by calling it this thing and framing it as like a magic, it brings you into a consideration of a different arrangement of the way, or not even a different arrangement. It brings you into an outsider's perspective to look at this thing. And the way he's doing it is using this strange language, which coupled with naming conventions that keep showing up, align with the construction of like an imaginary, but like politically potent, mysterious Orient. And I feel a lot less like that about this phrase in particular on the other end of the reading. However, there's still something that's being brought into play structurally here, because Rincewind, you know, our insider character, I guess, because Two Flowers are outsider character, Rincewind's our insider character. Rincewind doesn't know how to say economics, So he calls it echonomics. So that's where you get like the reflected sound as of underground spirits. Like, ha ha ha. But the work is still defamiliarizing and sort of exoticizing this thing. And that's something that I think is worth noting, because you can defamiliarize without exoticizing. That's not necessarily, I think, what this is going on. And maybe my read is a bit extreme here. I don't know if I'm sort of overreaching in my read of this, but I feel like it's supported with, again, when we talk about the duality of Pratchett, every time we talk about Two Flowers' background, it'll be this combination of this defamiliarized contemporary formulation, and then suddenly he'll switch it up and it'll be like racist. It'll just be racist.
Yeah. So an important thing that we did not mention is that, so the situation in which they are in is that Ankh-Morpork was destroyed in a wild conflagration. It's a massive fire that destroyed the city. And we see these two characters, this token of fantasy warriors that meet two survivors from the city. That will be Prince Wind, the failed wizard, and the first guide of the disc, and Two Flowers, the first tourist of the disc. And it is put center that the destruction of Ankh-Morpork was caused by Two Flowers. That is how it is centered. And this, coupled with the fact that, again, of this pair, one is the supposed interior character and another is the outside, a lot of anxieties about the outside is put on Two Flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he is blamed by the destruction of the single character that we have met so far immediately puts a certain frame of hostility to it. We are already put in a position in which we tend to accept the way that the Rincewind sees the world and Two Flowers as correct, which that is where a lot of the problems come, because, spoilers ahead, Rincewind is a piece of shit.
Rincewind sucks.
Rincewind is the fucking worst. And when you first read, it's not apparent that when Rincewind says that Two Flowers destroyed it, it does not mean the application of economics into a community completely destroyed it, which is what the entire first part is about.
Yes.
He's not putting that out. He singles Two Flowers as it. And again, he singles it as an outside force enacting violence upon his city, his land. And this is where the obvious racism comes. And because, especially how this is introduced, because listeners, you have to be aware why this sounds so weird until you understand, oh, economics, 80 pages later. So basically, Rincewind is telling, no, don't attack Two Flowers, it's a lot of gold, but he is protected by a great power than any magic. And this ex-spy of Grimmauser named Weasel, spell? Said Weasel, squatting down. No, but the magic of a kind, I think. Not the usual sort. I mean, it can turn gold into copper, while at the same time it is still gold. It makes men rich by destroying their possessions. It allows the weak to walk fearlessly among thieves. It passes through the strongest doors to leech the most protected treasuries. Even now, it has been enslaved, so that I must follow this madman willy-nilly and protect him from harm. It's stronger than you, Bravt. It is, I think, more cunning even than you, Weasel. What is called then this mighty magic? Rincewind shrugged. In our tongue, it is called reflected sound as of underground spirits. Is there any wine? So you can see immediately how fucking weird this is. But you can very much, if you picture this hostility, you're gonna see Two Flowers as a caricature of the Asian tourist bringing this economic violence or strange oriental mystical ways that are greater than the magics of the white man to these shores and bringing destruction. But if you read to the end and you know that this is economics, you say, oh, this is the perfect summation of the effect of economics, especially neoliberal financial institutions, open communities. So this is what brilliant, an amazing read of the vibes, but Pratchett, to get you there, to do this defamiliarization, like Quinn described it, he's drawing in a play of other language. But the language which is playing, he is reading you, the listener, and he's assuming a certain internalized orientalism of your part, and he's dragging that in. He's playing that in.
And something that I think is important here is in the way that the city formulation sort of comes here, because it's a city that's on a river that is sort of like the center of the universe, and it's being written by a British person. And so it's hard not to like read that, if not strictly as literally London, at least in part as like the seat of imperial power. It is sort of like a bastion of imperial production or imperial culture. So when you're introducing this outsider character and you're using these specific choices, I think it intensifies those like associations toward reading Two Flowers as being this orientalist external interloper.
And again, this is not helped because neither of them are much of characters either.
Right.
And this hurts because you don't know enough of Rincewind to know that he's an unreliable, miserable, bigoted piece of shit. And you don't know about Two Flowers to know what drives him and his motivations and how he may actually be very careless with the economic violence that he causes and clueless to that. Again, much in the neoliberal tradition.
Right. And there's very interesting things that wind up getting said with that. And even if you take that into context, I still can't give like a full pass to the work on the way that it does this stuff, because it keeps intruding at other parts of the development of this narrative. So if this was the only thing, sort of in the same way I'm forced to roll my eyes at the Big Bang thing, I might like get kind of weird vibes from this and then go, oh, well, he was bringing it around. He was sort of playing on the reader's expectations. And that's sort of a gotcha, which it is. It's also baked deep enough into a bunch of other stuff that's going on here that it's not that clean.
Nah, it got into the mud.
Yep, exactly.
And you know that he was getting into the mud. So I am a bit more charitable, not so much into this part, but later. Well, except a certain part that we're going to go back into later. On the way that he, Two Flowers, acts as the tourism, because I'm not getting a read of him as he acts as the way that the tourist is seen on the Imperial Core in the West, as is perceived, because he's not much presented as being a nuisance. He's more akin to how the Global South perceives tourists, as a desirable force of economy, even as it brings violence and destruction. And how, instead of being seen as annoyance, it is welcome in no matter what it's bringing. At any points it's accommodated. And in that aspect, I read him more like, ironically, a British tourist than the orientalist image that is seen on the imperial core cultures of the annoying tourists coming in and disrupting our perfect Western lives, except a particular weird remarks later, and the character of Rincewind. Because most of the weird thing is that while most of the people seem to react to him as a tourism, like people on the 80s on the Global South would react to tourism, Rincewind has the poor British behavior of dealing with tourism and the violence of tourism as an annoyance, as a personal slight to him. And I think that's an important distinction, because it shows an awareness of tourism as a force. Now, we go back to the previous point. He's clearly playing with certain ideas. And if you play with certain ideas, you're going to get dirty. But, you know, it's not how do we say it in the intro? It's not poor reproduction. That's the where I have to give the credit.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think that I mostly agree with you there. Where, again, a lot of it, and this is a way that humor works as well, is you set something up and then you subvert an expectation. And Ankh-Morpork presents itself as a very interesting character, but having only these 80 pages read, I don't have a full sense of the character yet. Where if what the text is doing is presenting the Ur-City as in fact being this place that exists on the Imperial Fringe, that is a part of the Global South, that is intruded upon by, like, colonizing, economically interfering outsiders or what have you, that is a very interesting statement that's being made. And I do think that, because we're going to talk about this a lot, the play out of the impact of tourism here definitely seems a lot more like Kingston, Jamaica. Like the tourism popping up there than in London. The dynamic seems a lot more close to that than it does people visiting London or San Francisco or Barcelona.
That last one has a lot to say. As examples, Bo, I think the Catalan people will disagree a lot with you about that being part of the Imperial Court.
That's a fair point. I'm not as familiar with the dynamics of like Spain internally or in its like context there.
Yeah, I have to say. Well, but we kind of covered what our text is about. That Color of Magic, at least part one, is about tourism. It's a book about tourism, which is unexpected, I will say.
It is very unexpected, and the way, again, it is about the violence of tourism, at least in the way that I'm reading it, where, again, you have the formulation of the Ur-City, which means that the introduction of tourism here is speaking to sort of an inevitable end of tourism in whatever context it's introduced. Like, this will happen in any city where this happens, and there's a very rapid escalation as Two Flowers' money begins to circulate. And he sort of intrudes upon social relations largely through disrupting them with money. That leads to the rapid formation of certain, like, social structures. Like, there's a...
I would argue that antisocial structures. Because I would argue that the whole thing is how about tourism is an antisocial force upon the community of Ankh-Morpork.
Yes, exactly. Which then ultimately leads to its destruction, with the caveat that we get at the start that because Ankh-Morpork is this eternal city, this reflecting object that all other cities are echoes of, it sort of must rebuild. It must come back together from the destruction. But it is pretty unambiguously saying, like, this is the violence that comes of this. It's bad.
Yeah. So I think we are struggling not to get ahead of ourselves, because there's a lot of things that the logical follow-up is actually build up on things later in the text, so maybe we should progress a bit more.
Yeah, do we want to talk about Rincewind?
I think we're going to talk about something even worse first, because we're going to have to talk about the arrival of Two Flowers in the city.
Right. You want to start us there?
I think you can start there, because I get the feeling that if I start talking on this, I'm not going to shut up.
So they shift us to new perspective characters here. Triple Wah and Blind Hugh, who sort of see Two Flowers arriving. And there's this way that Blind Hugh is talked about as having this sense for money. He has like a preternatural ability to sense coin or the potential for making money, which is very complicated because it's stepping on so many topics there, right? Where you're talking about disability, you're talking about poverty, you're talking about like potential houselessness. Like, because these are like beggars, basically. So that makes it very complicated when you talk about his money sense. Because how much is it looking at and demonizing these things about the character, about the context that they exist in? Of being poor, of being a beggar, of being a thief, of being blind, but having like a sharpened other sense versus how much is it looking at this as a product of the context, which then presents you with ways that you must shape yourself, ways that you must become to survive.
Yeah, and if that is not enough, we quickly learn that these characters, they are tangled with the structures of power of the oligarchs of the city of Ankh-Morpork. So it's a whole ball to uncover. And the thing is, I'm pretty sure that the nerds just ignore that this even happened. They just read past this part. Oh, funny characters, funny names. Let's go on. Because their names are basically two puns. It's basically two puns and two threats. And that's the thing that I have to mention. The names on the first book are awful. Terry, you made some awful names. There's not a single good name in this whole thing. I guess there's a skeletal figure that has a good name, and that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but these are two Victor Hugo characters. The way that they are talked about and everything, and they carry all of that baggage. Now, I don't understand why the need to bring this reference. Maybe it worked at the time as a quick reference to the way that the guild structure worked on those novels, so that puts the reader into ease, so that they immediately recognize the dynamics at play immediately when we follow up and we see how the city actually works and how power is distributed across the city. I don't know. I cannot talk for Terry Pratchett into that, but it's clear that this is obvious. These characters are just right outside of the Hunchback of Notre Dame. They really read the same. And there's a lot of play with language here. And there's an interesting way how about this monetary sense is, because it also reads a lot like when you are immersed in precarity, the noticing when someone is not affected by that precarity, it is a sense. When you are subject to this kind of violence, when this is displaced upon you, you become really good at sensing this, which on the popular vernacle, that's where the whole thing about checking your privilege comes from. It's when you get this stink out of someone, you can read that, you can sense that, and that is called out. So there is certainly in play that yes, this is a sense too. And again, on the context of 83, this echoes the ruptures that are happening across British society, where it becomes pretty easy to see who's profiting from the deal with the devil and who are the ones that are being sacrificed on these pits of precarity. So there is this awareness that this is, I would say, the sense of class consciousness expressed without using the language of materialism, which, because you don't have the language of class solidarity or materialism, it seems almost like a supernatural sense. There's a lot to be said also from the point of view of disability, because there's a play here that disability is equal to loss of function. And these characters, one is described without having mobility issues, despite their name, and another is described as having pretty good perception, despite, again, their name. And it plays against that assumption that disability means that you don't have that function, that you cannot do that. And this is the most common form of ableism that you want to face, is exactly that. That there are things that you can and cannot do based on your disabilities. That's one of the most common disabilities. And he's clearly playing with that. But the way that he's playing with it, again, it's drawing on these prejudices and this context, and that you're going to paint disabled people and poor people and people in precarious conditions as untrustworthy, as liars, and of course, the stamp that every disabled person have to face, laziness. But again, a lot of this comes from playing with the language, and for the English language, that means playing with a lot of ableism. It's speaking as a non-speaker, it's amazing how much effort you need to do not to do an accidental ableism, because that's pretty much half the vocabulary, apparently.
Yeah, it's pretty absurd.
Yeah, but at the same point, I really like the difference between being able to do it or maybe not being able to do it, because it draws disability as a social category instead of being something innate. That someone being labeled blind does not mean that they are not perfectly functional using that ableist definition of associated with productivity. That does not mean you cannot do it. Same thing, while WA is not able to quickly assess the situation and quickly leave the scene, they are able to do that no matter the social categories of disabled that they are measured through a capitalist idea of productivity, of human efficiency, of functionality. And for all its weirdness, we don't see the nail of accommodations to these people. When we see violence threatened and forced upon them, it's not focused on their disabilities. And yeah, while unpolished, it draws things to be worth revisiting in interesting ways. And I can say he definitely does later. But I think this distinction between maybe you can or maybe you should not, and the realities of actual debt, I have to say. You should also, by the same logic, you would also think that maybe a deaf person should not be doing podcasting. And here I am on the same view. Maybe someone that is blind, maybe should not be working on optics, a field that is all about those things. But apparently my limitations also make me pretty sensitive to small changes that my more abled colleagues have problems noticed. So I think it is toying with that notion that disability is not as straightforward. But again, it's getting Van Armand in a really weird way. And I kind of wish he had not done this way. I know he does it better, but yeah, it's very rough to read. And again, the thing is, it's worth considering, it's worth discussing. There's a lot to be said about that. But sometimes you just don't want to deal with certain shit. And I would understand how this enough would be good reason to give this book a pass. But again, if you are interacting with these ideas, you have to see that this is a much better treatment than, than Victor Hugo. But then again, there's 200 years between them, so...
Yeah, we wind up, they are entangled with, like, structures of power. So we get a little scene between them and Emor and Whiffle.
Again, those names.
Yeah. And I don't know. I don't feel like there's, like, a lot to get into excessively here. Like, it isn't sort of in the confines of what you just talked about. It's mostly sort of the reveal that they operate in this context, that they serve these functions, that they have this employment.
We are introduced now only to the Thieves Guild, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we learned that Ankh-Morpork Pork is basically, it's an oligarchy, that the city is basically ruled by various guilds, and one of them seems to be the Guild of Thieves that quickly gets an interest in our tourist. And are we introduced to the legitimate form of government already, or not yet?
I don't think that they show up until they capture Rincewind.
Yeah, I think we get mentioned maybe that WA and Hook are sending them intel, that they are spying for them, but I think that's it, yeah. Yeah, and then we have the Thieves Guild Master and their second doing bits, and then we see Two Flowers going for a drink, and we see how Two Flowers interacts with the world, and we meet Rincewind.
Yeah, Rincewind, like we said, is a piece of shit. He sucks. So Rincewind is a failed wizard and becomes very sort of opportunistic as a way to survive, I guess.
Yeah, he's basically the anti-work champion of the class of 79, and it's the only good thing about Trinstrand.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I feel like I have to read this piece of description of Rincewind. Because it's haunted me since I read it. I'm having so much trouble making sense of what it means.
I think I also have that bookmark.
So, let me read this. It's page 19 in my copy. Look at him, scrawny, like most wizards, and clad in a dark red robe on which few mystic sigils were embroidered in tarnished sequins. Some might have taken him for a mere apprentice enchanter, who had run away from his master out of defiance, boredom, fear, and a lingering taste for heterosexuality. Around his neck was a chain bearing the bronze octagon that marked him as an alumnus of Unseen University, the High School of Magic, whose time and space transcended campus, is never precisely here or there. So that bit confuses me because particularly the heterosexuality thing, I'm not sure in what direction I'm supposed to read that. And there's like 100 different potential ways to read it. Is it about institutional asexuality, like with monks? Is it about pederastry, which is like a historical practice? So I'm so confused.
Well, I know that lingering taste of heterosexuality is a great name for the group chat.
For sure.
It's so baffling.
This is something that, like, I literally just don't think can be resolved. Like, I don't know. I don't know what sense to make of it. And all I can say is this thing got said, it could have a million different implications. And he doesn't go anywhere with any of them. Like, the text doesn't go anywhere with any of them. So why did you say it? What are you trying to do? Like, why?
Right. What is this? What is the function of this sentence?
It does nothing but confuse me and make me wonder, like, are you a homophobe? It was very confusing. The passage then goes on to talk about how Rincewind has an innate, quote unquote, gift for languages. And that's what he uses to be a little piece of shit, mostly.
Yeah, my note on that is immediately next is, well, for someone that has a gift for languages, he does not think much of anyone. So it's surprising he even developed this.
It's astonishing.
So the text really does not get much about that, solving the mystery. But again, there's no way that you can solve the mystery of the lingering taste of heterosexuality. Well, it's pretty this idea that the wizards don't fuck. That is kind of an idea. There's later on the text a part in which Rincewind describes using magic to do stuff that you still need to put the effort. So by the 20 years that it takes for you to get the spell working that makes naked virgins appear in front of you, you are so eaten by mercury fumes that you have no idea what to do that and why you thought that was a good idea as a spell.
That comes up later. It's very, that's joke that doesn't hit for me. It's a joke that just like feels nasty. It feels really gross.
And it's weird because the weird part is that I could buy this being something that Rincewind sees the world as. It's very weird that it is the world seeing Rincewind because
that's right.
Usually this kind of piece of shit, it's you that are doing this.
That is, I think, what is so confusing about it to me is that we haven't stepped into Rincewind's perspective so much yet. And so this is sort of an external assessment and judgment of him. And that's not a judgment I would ever make. And I don't need every judgment the book renders to be a judgment that I would make. But I find myself so thrown by it that I'm thrown into a bunch of questions that I don't think that the text intended. Or like that I don't see it contributing to the experience of reading this thing to be like, what the hell? Because what is this? It's also funny to think about like asexual wizards, because that also feels like it's tied to a time and a context, because we live in a post-Elminster world.
My wizards fuck.
And I'm not saying it's good that Elminster fucks, but I'd argue, in fact, that for the most part, Elminster fucking is a huge mistake because it just gets weird.
Yeah. I don't believe that Elminster eats pussy, so...
No.
So I don't think it's good for anyone involved.
So I just... It's such a strange... I feel like I'm just going to keep looping around and going back to, like, what happened? Like, why would you do that? Unless we move on, because there's... Again, it's something that can't be resolved. So instead... He's good at languages.
He's good at languages.
He assigned those points in the character creator and got, like, the linguistics feat.
Yeah, because that's basically how we have to see Rincewind is he's a grifter. He hangs around in bars, pretend he's a wizard, and somehow uses his gift of languages on his grifts. So you can think probably he grifts merchants or whatever. Somehow he makes a living out of this. And this is important because of the way that Two Flowers interacts with the world. Because as the obvious joke in 83 about a tourist is that it's the Monty Python sketch of the Hungarian phrasebook in which he goes around with a guidebook and he reads sentences aloud from it. And this leaves the people from Ankh-Morpork fascinated because they think that there is a magical book that tells this strange little man what to say. And Rincewind, because of his supposed gift with languages, is the first that gets to interact with Two Flowers. Well, let's say between human beings. Even if we're going to see Rincewind's perspective on this.
Yeah, it's also so strange because it also shows the way that, like, when we look at, like, the whole frame of tourism and the violence of that, Rincewind is in part creating a bridge through which the violence is facilitated. But I do want to read, because I think, you know, we're like an hour and a half into this thing and 20 pages in. So
we said it was dense.
We said it was dense. So I think that there's a lot to talk about in the next several pages about language and linguistics and translation and anthropology that starts here with Rincewind trying to figure out what language to speak to Two Flower. Quote, Rincewind switched to High Borogravian, to Vengelschmecht, Sumtri, and even Black Arugu, the language with no nouns and only one adjective, which is obscene. Each was met with polite incomprehension. In desperation, he tried heathen trob, and the little man's face split into a delighted grin. And this becomes a vector for him to make a bunch of jokes about trob, which is framed expressly as a language which a group of islanders speaks, and the way that it has to reach really far for words to, like every word has a valence or like a literal meaning that is strange or absurd. For example, mercenaries are translated as warriors who fight for the tribe with most milknut meal. And it again is doing this thing where this is just him being unconscionably British. And like, I think it sucks really bad because that's not really how language works.
No.
Or in the ways that it does, most language isn't actively being processed or thought about in that way. Like when we say freelancer, we're not meaning one free of like lordly association who sells the services of their spear, because that's not how it works. Like that's literally maybe what the word means, but that's not what we're doing.
And someone that can maybe say that the legend has herself a gift of languages, that's also not how you learn languages. So I'm pretty amazed at how he learned these languages, thinking of language this way.
Right. Because like, I'm not fluent in any language aside from English. I've got training a little bit in Japanese. I took like 2.5 years of Japanese language courses in university. And I live in San Diego. It's a border town. I'm like, I know a little bit of Spanish. Like, I know enough Spanish to bridge conversational gaps as is necessary. But that's it is an absurd way to look at language. And specifically, the language name being Trob marks a flag in my head because I'm pretty sure it might be a callback to the Trobriand Islands, where Margaret Mead did a bunch of seminal anthropology work. and it reeks of like this. Anthropology is a complicated field. Let me just say that like up front, where it has a very complicated history being developed as an apparatus of empire, which has since shifted pretty dramatically in ways that ideally aren't extensions of imperial violence. But this formulation of language, calling it Traub, pulling on the anthropological association there, potentially, this is again, maybe a reach, but that is what flared up in the back of my mind. It is this very sort of like accounting for language as an anthropologist who is observing and engaging with a quote unquote primitive culture. And it drives me mad because that's not how culture works. That's not how people work. That's not how languages work. The entire like run of this was just really frustrating to me.
And the worst part is, again, because this is into the lands of Rincewind. And well, again, he does not think high of anyone. He talks down to literally everyone, from the proprietor of the mended room, the tavern in which they are, to about the people that two flowers came to see, to about the local presence, about the cultures that he tries different languages. It is, again, he always speaks from this imperial positioning, a very self-centered view. And I think the best comment on that is, it's not even on part one, but later there is a part in which Rincewind wished he had paid more attention to anthropology classes. And my note there is simple. Yeah, me too, buddy.
Yep.
But I think it is important at this point we tell why there was such a conflict in terms of language, because of where Two Flowers comes from.
Yeah, Two Flowers is from what is called a couple of different things, including the Counterweight Continent and the Agadian Empire. So he is from the sense that they get as they construct this space is sort of El Dorado meets like imperial bureaucratic China. It's a land like super rich in gold.
Yeah, but rather than an actual historical notion of China, it's more the hyper object in the Western imagination of China.
Yes, that's a super important thing. Again, it is this really heightened and intensified mystic orient showing up here, which again is at times being used as a lens through which to defamiliarize things. And I'd argue even doing that to defamiliarize things is still sort of doing the thing, especially when there's so many pieces of the structure of this thing that are literally just that, and they're not defamiliarizing pieces of our modern culture. Like, they have a child emperor, wizened vizier, power struggle thing going on.
Yeah, but as we go get later then, at the same time, there's an actual good insight on actual historical China and on the dynamics of the West and what drove Western imperialism and capitalism in the first place, which again are very important for the theme of economics. So these things are going hand on hand with an actual sober and materialistic aware sense of this. So it's massive whiplash, but you're probably gonna get the next session section.
Yeah, so that's where Two Flowers comes from. Rincewind steps in to sort of bridge the gap linguistically so that he can secure housing here at the Broken Drum. And this is where Two Flowers starts paying people in Renu, the coin that he has brought with him. And this also brings a really interesting thing where they start talking about gold as being valuable in and of itself, where the coins that Two Flower has brought are tested for like purity. They're like, oh, have we been scammed? And they're like, so this isn't a coin like the coins that we're used to. And people get sort of up in arms, but they're like, no, you don't understand. Our coins are cut with like a lot of copper. They're not very pure gold. This is 100% pure gold. And that makes it incredibly valuable, which is interesting in the way that it positions money and gold and sort of everything about that.
Yeah, because that part, when they go to the alchemist and they test the coin, you can see a switch flipping. Until then, every interaction with Two Flowers and his source of income was seen on what could that do within the context of Ankh-Morpork Park, how that influenced the social relationships, how that took part into a human economy. Because again, the gold coins that they were receiving, they were treating as their own coins, as signifiers of human relationships. So they were seen as two flowers entering into that system, entering into the human economy of Ankh-Morpork, entering into the community. The moment that happens, the gold coin is seen as an innate value to the gold. It's not a value of being part into the human economy in the social dynamics. It seems as innate. And because it has this innate value, all bets are off now. And this is when we see this flip touching, because suddenly, because of the innate value of this gold, everything to get this is justified. And it has value no matter what you do to the social relationships that exist. You could literally torch your entire life to the ground because your value is no longer coming from them. It's coming from this pile of gold. It's worth pursuing.
Exactly. And that's the huge thing that this scene does, is it creates this flip where one person understands the implications of this, and then the implications start spreading like a conflagration across the community, such that the most important thing very quickly becomes squeezing whatever you can.
Yeah, and this is exactly what our hero, Rincewind, does. He squeezes like 15 gold coins from two flowers, offering his service as a guide. And then he tries to get out of town on the fastest horse. And just a quick scam. The thing is, because of this disruption that is happening, he draws the attention of the highest authority in the city of Ankh-Morpork, its ruler, the patrician. And Rincewind is captured by the patrician, and the two of them have a little tete-a-tete, which might be the most interesting conversation on the book.
Yeah, there's a lot going on here. And it shows that the relationship starts coming to the fore here, with the relationship between the Agadian Empire and Ankh-Morpork is sort of the most important thing, because it comes out that no, Rincewind didn't steal anything. He used quote unquote false coinage, but that false coinage was Renu, which then brings into the patrician the context of, oh, so this is the money of the Agadian Empire. And he explains that more or less we in Ankh-Morpork don't have anything that they want, and anything that we would want that they have, we can't afford.
Which anyone that is a student of materialism knows, this is exactly the relationships for most of history between the fringe communities that make the West today and the rich Asian constructs. And the whole drive on the 7th century of capitalism was ultimately to create something that could actually lead for them to acquisition of the resources there.
Mm-hmm.
The main drive of capitalism was exactly to solve this puzzle that has been hunting them from at least as far away as the axial age. And just as that time, they used a form of slavery to create these markets. They used other forms of slavery, perfected through capitalism later. And again, this is an extremely sober view of history and the relationships, as well as the relationships between an imperial core, galactic politics, tributary relationships, how culture flows. And then it's sprinkled with the most orientalist shit. Again, the very idea that that those things are enforced through direct violence, or the idea of the inscrutable Orientals that one time send one message, the other send another contradiction, and then this is presented because of another Orientalist stereotype of the child emperor and the scheming vizier. Again, these things are going on the same paragraph. How it's possible?
It's very frustrating in that there's this presentation, again, of this pretty grounded, sober analysis of these imperial relations. He even sort of gets into the idea of there being a tributary politic, but understanding Ankh-Morpork is existing outside of that tributary politic, which I understand is an assumption that gets challenged later. Like, that's a point of misunderstanding. While then, yeah, like, leaning into this, like, oh, they don't even know what they want. They send a bunch of mixed messages. It's really hard to, like, see through and understand. It's completely inscrutable. Where what they've laid out right before this seems incredibly scrutable. The dynamic, this potential, like, imperial fringe relationship is like one of the most scrutable dynamics that we have in 1983 and in 2022.
This is where Pratchett's clear writing backfires, because if at least the writing was not clear, but it is. So there's not even that ambiguity in the text. It's very clear whenever he writes something. Well, except the lingering sense of heterosexuality, whatever that means.
Yeah, that one time. Yeah. So, a fascinating run of pages that is, it is the encapsulation of this duality that we've been talking about, where this strong sense of a materialist understanding of geopolitics, of relationships between empires and tributaries, or the imperial core and the fringes, then is completely undercut by him complaining about how he doesn't understand the mysterious, mystical, oriental people, which is just so deeply frustrating.
And again, nerds don't think about that, and they probably just read past that. But the thing is, I think they missed it both. I think they missed the material analysis, and they missed the orientalism. So what are they getting from these books is a mystery to me.
It's weird. It's super weird. Again, because it's like that's what all of this is about. Like, this entire first section of this book is so deeply about this.
Yeah, this is basically a part in which the patrician drags Rincewind and tells you, here are the themes of this book. This is what this is about. Look, you think it's a good idea that everyone has a lot of gold? You think that the gold standard is a great idea? This will ruin every single one of you. Do you understand? No. Okay, then I'm going to threaten you with violence. But this is what it is. Turns to the camera. These are the themes of this book.
Right.
Doing everything for economy. This is how you get Thatcher's England. Please don't vote her for a second term.
Yes, exactly. It's like dreadfully transparent. Again, looking at that time, but then even speaking to our current context, we can look at it and like we're so much more entrenched in that neoliberal state of the world because of the knock-on effects of the Thatcher and Reagan administrations and everything that they did to fuck the world up. But it's also interesting what's going on here in that the patrician threatens violence. He says you have to protect Dewflower. Rincewind, you can talk to him. We know that you're in some way in relation to him. He perhaps naively sort of trusts you. You have to make sure that he stays safe. And if he doesn't stay safe, you have to go do that or I'm going to hurt you. And if he doesn't stay safe, then like everyone here is going to get hurt because the big empire, the Agadian Empire, is going to bring violence to bear to correct this situation, which I think is an interesting move, because the extent to which that is true, I think, is up in the air. Is this the patrician simply invoking the specter of this violence, or is it like actually a part of the relationship that's at play here?
From what I understand on a later conversation, I think because he's talking to Rincewind on the language of violence, and it's clearly working, he translates that, because even what the patrician already says before is not compatible with that, because it shows that the patrician is aware that violence is already happening and that the violence is going to be economic, if any. And then it shows clear that he is more aware of the tributary relationships of the galactic politics, that they are too irrelevant to even suffer direct violence. That at the most literal would be one of the other city-states of the hub. They will just pay them off to make Ankh-Morpork irrelevant.
Right. Exactly.
Which, again, will not be the same kind of violence that he's projecting on Rincewind. He's using that because it's a lever that he found that worked with these silly little men.
Right. And then not understanding in this context that the violence is sort of working both ways, where in leveraging this threat of violence against Rincewind, he like sort of foments and intensifies the violence of the tourist site of tourism relationship that gets created, which leads to the city burning down. So that's very interesting.
Immediately when you get back, when we meet Better Two Flowers, we see the effects of this deterioration of the social relationships, because basically there is a lot of murder happening around the Two Flowers. Basically, everyone gets the smell of gold and they start using adventurer's logic to it. And everyone is there for the gold.
And I feel like that is the function of that scene, pretty much. There's not a whole lot more to say about it than in this very short span of time, Rincewind has left the context, he's returned to the context, and in the intervening time, the violence has escalated so far because of this relationship that it's just an out-and-out brawl. People are, like, slaughtering each other in plain sight now.
And there's an interesting follow-up to this scene. After the violence happens, after people kill themselves over the gold that Two Flowers carries, we see the introduction, what is a fan favorite institution, which is the Ankh-Morpork City Watch. And I was quite surprised by the way that they are introduced in this book. And I kind of want to ask Queen what was their impression of the City Watch meeting them for the first time.
Yeah, it's almost a non-impression. I don't. They sort of just, there's so much else going on in the scene. They, like, my brain didn't really grab onto them and, like, form much of an impression. They just kind of, like, were there. I don't know. It's probably a bit disappointing for people who might have, like, an investment in the watch. But, yeah, my first impression is nothing.
What doesn't mean an impression is how not much of cops they were. Especially on the rest of the part one, where we see a lot of cops. The watch are surprisingly not cop-like. And I think a lot of... Because I think that I wanted to revisit is how much the watch map to the modernity conception of policing and police forces, and how much they actually map to historical community defense. And I was wondering how much of cops would you say the watch were?
Again, it's hard to say. Certainly not as much cops as the other cops that show up in this part are. It looks like they're there in part to actually attempt like a de-escalation. They aren't showing up necessarily as a strict threat of violence. And so like it's interesting seeing the way in terms of that relationship to the cops, right? This is either something that is taking place outside that sort of framework, or it is a propagandistic idealization of the police where, no, they actually do show up and they help and they like de-escalate and they sort of take care of people in some regards. And they're still like sort of self-interested in the way that everyone here is sort of acting in rabid self-interest, but not in the way that you would expect cops to act out of self-interest.
Oh, no, their self-interest is less, you know, barging in and planting violence and using the privilege of violence and more. I don't want to die. I hate violence. I don't want to see violence happen around me.
Yeah.
Which is like, that's not very cop-like.
No, not particularly.
So yeah. Also, they don't terminate any beloved family pets. There's no operative use of passive voice.
Yep.
Yeah. That was a surprising introduction. I did not even remember the watch being on this book, to be honest.
They're there for so quickly.
The thing is, this is not how The Flowers destroys the city.
No.
No, how it destroys it is by opening the city to international financing. No, wait, that was Thatcher. That's how Thatcher destroyed the city. No, he destroyed the city by introducing them to very innovative financial institutions. Oh, no, wait, they did exactly the same thing. Huh, funny. So what is that Two Flowers introduced Rincewind and then the rest of the city to?
Yeah, I think because like this is sort of the back 40 pages of this are pretty much, especially with the attack of analysis that we're making, because we could talk a little bit about like some of the funny guys that show up, which sometimes I'm sure we will talk about them. But like this section is so about this that insurance is what what comes up. He's an insurance calculator. Like he Two Flowers is an insurance guy. He tabulates and calculates risk related to different ventures to determine how much like an insurance policy should cost. And no one there is familiar with insurance. And it's interesting because there's this sort of two threads that are running through, which are the assumptions that these people should have or like do have outside of the antisociality of the tourist thing. And the way that the function of tourism here is to incite violence to the point and antisociality to the point that people who are just being introduced to this for the first time sort of see the only way to engage with the structure that makes sense. And that's what one might call insurance fraud, because they don't talk about like the conditions of fraudulence here. They just say, oh, so you're making a bet that my tavern won't burn down. And if you got the bet wrong and the tavern does burn down, you give me a bunch of your super valuable coins. Yeah, ha, 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 I don't want my tavern to burn down. That would be stupid, as he's pouring oil into the basement to set the thing ablaze, which is where this ends up. Like, insurance is like this escalation that brings the city to the point of conflagration. The owner of the tavern burns it down.
Surprise, surprise. But the thing is, this only happens, and this way is important, because there was the priming from stopping to think about the economy on social terms and starting thinking of it on antisocial terms.
Exactly.
Because even towards it, this tavern is my whole life. It will be awful for me that it burns down. And the thing is, probably one day before, he meant that truly.
Yes, exactly.
This tavern is my whole life. It's my community. It's my place on the community. That will be disastrous to me. But now he said like a wink because he's being primed antisocially.
Exactly. And that's like a huge, huge thing. It exists in this place because for Two Flower, it's sort of completely naturalized. Like the way that insurance works has become so normalized that he's not primed to think in this way. And the day before, people wouldn't have wanted these things to happen. They wouldn't want to have their tavern burned down. But you introduce the tourist into this configuration and everything that the tourist represents, and the tourist sort of selling you a piece of the like social and economic structure, the antisocial and economic structure of the tourist's homeland. And these antisocial logics start to develop so quickly that what was unthinkable a mere day before seems like the not only thinkable, but like the most logical move to make.
And again, I was joking, but this maps perfectly to what Pratchett observed the vibes happening as neoliberalism was not only, well, it was not being born because it already started on the imperial fringe with Chile, where it was actually born, but matured in the imperial court with Reagan and Thatcher. And he observed how things like the right to buy, which allowed people that were in council housing to become landlords, and how the displacement of the precarization through tourism to the places which were already reshaped by neoliberalism, how the conditions of the workers on the imperial core could be alleviated by presenting the vacation as the thing that they could displace all their violence, all their precarity there, that they could suffer the rest of the neoliberal violence if they could have the vacation as any neoliberal invention. It shows this coupling with those transformations that were necessary for the things that had larger repercussions, like, as I said, the millennia-long scam that has been the City of London becoming more than an instrument of financialization of national capital, to becoming this overlord of international capital and all these absurd instruments that lead to people due to the 83 equivalent of burning your own tavern for debt, which again, it's the complete destruction of communities that neoliberalism has done across the world, by replacing the last bastions of the social with this antisocial logic. That it was worth sacrificing everyone in your town as long as you can get a check from it. And again, this is an excellent read of the maturing of neoliberalism into the shape which the two of us were born into. And considering that people now don't have a good read on it, that people in 2022 still don't see these vibes and don't see what they do, that the people at the time did not see that, and that's how they got the second term, that any opposition did not see these vibes, that's how we got Blue Labour.
Right.
And he saw it. He saw it as it was happening, and he was able to process those vibes and to metaphor, get a good materialistic reading that is extremely accessible, that you don't need to go through all the nonsense of theory. It's there. It's simple. This is a mirror of what happens when the instruments of neoliberalism get into your home.
And it's especially stark, I think, in 2022, when we're living in a time when the knock-on effects of this have gotten so intense that a lot of the world, like, literally is on fire, and that violence is displaced disproportionately to the global south. And so it's happening. It's not so speculative. Nope, it happened. You got it.
Yeah, that's it. This is the thing. Yeah, literally gonna end. Yeah, neoliberalism gonna end with literally everything going in flames. Yes.
Yeah. So do we want to talk about how I feel like that is honestly, like, that's the next 40 pages of the book. There's one more thing I think is of, like, really interesting note, and that is in the confrontation that is coming to a head.
Oh, how tourism spontaneously generates cops?
Yeah, tell me about that, please.
Yeah, so basically other guilds get interested on two flowers. So we have the guild, the Thieves Guild and the Assassins Guild. And we have these established institutions of power that they get against each other. And we have, what, 12 pages in which we have the head of the Thieves Guild and the head of the Assassins Guild doing bits at each other. And after a lot of tension, it seems that they reached an agreement how this benefits everyone, how the previous forms of power can accommodate this. The problem is there's a new guild in town, because now that tourism is a thing, there needs to be gentrification. And the first wave of violence to reduce the criminal element comes in and looks at the previous forms of authority and says, you have to go. And we have a fight between the newly entitled, what is their names? Guild of Merchants and Tourism or something like that.
It is the Guild of Merchants and Traders.
Yeah, and they are very worried about the beggars, the thieves, the assassins. They don't think that he's amenable to tourism, and they want to get rid of the previous structures of power. And all the guilds, they are sending in their cops, and they basically fight each other.
Until Rincewind then interferes, and the specific resolution of that becomes less important because
insurance fraud happens.
Insurance fraud happens, right. And then they have to escape the city. So they do. And that brings us sort of full circle to the start.
Now, there is another character that is involved into this, that is introduced because... So, that is a character in this world, as probably most people that have a tangential relationship with this world are aware.
And it's funny because he's there.
He's there.
Almost not worth talking about.
It's like The Watch. It's one of these things that people know, and he's barely there. And he's mostly there because... So, wizards, there's a lot of nonsense about the Eighth Color and Dr. Reina, which honestly neither of us found interesting. So...
It genuinely doesn't feel worth talking about, yeah.
No, I think we'll probably touch that later on other parts, even by virtue, because there is less to talk about. Sorry. But so the thing is, wizards must be claimed by debt itself. That is a dubious benefit that they have. So Rincewind, for being this close to this all this violence, is constantly on the threat of being claimed by debt. So we keep seeing that popping up here and then. And because debt is there to kill Rincewind in a way. It's one of the most likable characters of the story so far. We also see that interacting with other characters, which is probably how the final beat of this part ends. And what can you tell me about that? Because again, it's going to be another character that everyone wants to hear your opinion on that. So Ken, take it.
Yeah, so I do think it's interesting that Death does show up at the scene of the insurance fraud and helps to light the match, pretty much. So I think that that's interesting. But Death is so not a character right now. And I know that Death will become like a significant player. For me, the most interesting thing was the way that Pratchett describes his voice. It's like this deep sound of like doors creaking and this enormous bellow that is very ominous and sort of elemental. And that's cooler than anything he actually does. And I think that like if we take the extension of Death in this, at least here, as the physicalization of precarity, it does get interesting that Death is sort of the one who's present at the moment of the fraud. But like as a guy, I don't have anything to say about him because there's nothing that he does that's worth saying anything about.
I have to say, the thing that I like about that, is that Death gets pretty good bits this time. Because again, he gets to help committing insurance fraud, which great bit. He gets to be constantly frustrated at Rincewind, which again, same, also great bit. And then that he tries to get Rincewind killed, less out of animosity, but because, come on, do me a favor. You're messing the whole thing. I was supposed to have killed you already. I'm supposed to kill you in this other place in 2 hours. Can you at least get there? Please don't miss your appointment a second time. You're screwing the whole system.
Yeah.
He gets great bits. What can I say?
It's pretty good, yeah. But yeah, it is interesting seeing these huge figures show up and just having them kind of pass through the experience. Like, it would have been very easy for me to go through this and not mention the Watch or Death because they're so tangential to, like, what, at least what makes this compelling to me.
Yeah, and another great character is the Patrician. But the reason why not many people are going to ask you about that, because it's something pretty weird that's going to happen. Basically, the Patrician, as he's presented on this book, gets rewritten out of existence.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So Pratchett basically is aware that he did not do a great job on his characterization. And then we have the Patrician that people actually like as a character, Lord Vetinari. So I don't know if he caused any impression as he is now, but a lot of people pretend this was not even the same character.
For me, what I like about the Patrician is completely functional. Again, Ankh-Morpork is the most well-realized character here, and the Patrician, in any way that he works as a character, it's as an element or a reflection of Ankh-Morpork as a character, and that is, this is how local power operates. This is how the ruling class here brings to bear the threat of violence, etc.
Yeah, considering especially the way that his secret police and spy network work on this book compared with later books, it gets the feeling that he's less a character. He's more like a genius Loki of the city, almost.
Yeah, okay.
And after that, the insurance fraud happens. Everything burns, not only the tavern, the entire of the city. And we meet back into the present. The Grey Mauser ex-spy does not believe what Rincewind told, but still is enough hesitant that he does not go along with their plan of robbing them and lets them go into their journeys. And he's spooked by something that I don't remember that makes him think that maybe there is some truth. Oh yeah, I think he robbed Rincewind and he stole something from him.
Oh yeah, he steals like a pocket watch.
Oh, yeah.
So he steals a pocket watch. The pocket watch has a little demon in it. He doesn't like the demon, so he throws it away.
Yeah. Yeah, he basically sees that as a confirmation that there might be some truth to what Rincewind is telling. Because a lot of the technology that Two Flowers has is powered by demons. This is not very important. So basically, another character is the demon that lives on a box that paints photographies, basically, which is a minor character so far. And a more important piece of a character is the luggage of the tourist, which is made of sentient wood. So it's both luggage and a guardian dog of sorts of Two Flowers. And they are probably mentioned on the story that Rincewind tells these two characters. So when he sees the pocket watch that is all made of gold and has a demon inside, this is probably clear confirmation that there's some truth to that story, and that's probably what spooks him.
Exactly. And so they write off wanting to sort of just get away from this thing.
Yeah, and basically walk out of the book and leave our protagonists to continue with their adventures in the next part.
Yeah.
So anything else? I think that's it about Color of Magic.
I think so, yeah.
So anything that, any weird details that we were not able to swerve into?
Not that I can think of. Like the weirdest detail was like the lingering taste for heterosexuality, which,
yeah,
I like the paint demon, like the little guy in the camera. I think it's funny that part of the function of the demon is also to compel people to do whatever the person holding the camera like instructs them to do. It's kind of that is how cameras work. Haha.
Yeah. And there are great bits between the demon and Rincewind, because the demon is one of the few likable characters on this part.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he's like, oh, I ran out of pink, so now the photos are going to be in black and white. You should maybe not have taken so many photos about naked women. And how they go into the temples and the priests protest that everything is too sacred for photos, and they start giving money, and suddenly it's not so sacred anymore.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's all sort of like building on that overall arc of the violence of tourism that we talked about, but it's a very interesting way. He's a likable guy. He's just like a little grumpy man in a box.
He's just a little guy that has a job.
I like that a lot, but we really touched on most of the things. The thing about the back half of this reading is it's a lot of set pieces. It's a lot of action scenes or like sequences, which are like fun to read. Pratchett, again, very, very, very easy to read. But there's also not necessarily a lot to say about the conflicts there.
No. I mean, the two fight scenes that we see here, both the ones at the first brawl while Rincewind is talking with the patrician, and later between the three different guilds as they talk about who gets to gentrify Ankh-Morpork, I was impressed. But this was not something that I expressed. It's very clean, dynamic.
But what is there, obviously, was fascinating. Next time, we're going to be talking about parts 2 and 3, I believe.
Yeah, I've managed to read both parts. So, yeah, I think we'll probably be talking more or less as much time as we talk about this part. Yeah. It's not about economics. So if you liked our economics talk, tweet, we're not going to do it again.
Damn shame.
If you did not like our economics talk,
good news.
Great. We are not touching it again.
Yep. Yeah. So you ready to bring things to the close here then?
I have no idea how we're going to close this. It's just as I don't know which we're going to name this. So
yeah. I will be back soon with more Color of Magic. Hopefully you like this. You know, we're just starting off this project, keeping it kind of informal. You know, let us know what you think, I guess, if it catches your attention. And yeah, if you want to read up to be on track with us next time, we know for sure what we're going to be talking about. So parts 2 and 3, The Sending of 8 and something else. The Lure of the Worm.
Oh, worm.
Oh, worm indeed.
And if you did not get anything else from this episode, don't burn your tavern for insurance.
Yeah, don't do that, please. No insurance fraud.